This is Eat, Praying, Plues. That's who I was 10 minutes ago, and I still am. And I'm here with No Nonsense Nutrition. And yeah, it's kind of about nutrition, but you know, it's really all about health. And one of the things that came to my attention this week really, really strongly was the fact that the new guidelines had been sent out regarding the use of antibiotic prescriptions that are given for sinus infections. 20% of all the antibiotics that are prescribed in America are for sinus infections, and you know what? They don't work. I get clients in my practice all the time that have sinus complaints, and they will come in and they will complain about pain around the eye socket, perhaps in that area between the eyes, sometimes in the face or even in the temples. They'll say, oh, I have a sinus infection. I blow my nose and it's yellow or green. I know I have an infection. I have to go to the doctor and get antibiotics. Well, a really beautiful study was done at Washington University where they gave people a placebo or they gave them amoxicillin. That's an antibiotic that's often used at 500 milligram doses three times a day. And all of these people had been diagnosed with an active sinus infection. They had congestion and cough and headaches and runny nose and sore throat and fever and all the constellation. But the study confirmed what a lot of us have suspected for a long time. Most uncomplicated cases of sinus infection clear up on their own, with or without antibiotics. So the routine prescribing of antibiotics for common sinus infections is probably fairly soon going to become a thing of the past, because randomized trials are really the gold standard of research studies, and this one was printed in the Journal of the American Medical Association. So, what it pointed to was the really serious problem of antibiotic resistance that is developing not only in the United States, but all over the world. And so our federal government has responded to that once again, because they announced that farmers and ranchers would have to restrict their use of a critical class of antibiotics in cattle and pig and chickens and turkey, because the practices are contributing to the threat of bacterial infections that are resistant to treatment. The medicines are known as cephalosporins, and they include things like Keflex, and they are among the most prescribed antibiotics that are used to treat pneumonia and strep throat and skin and urinary tract infections. A lot of doctors use them before surgery. And what they found out was that when antibiotics were given to animals, animals actually grew faster. And so back at the beginning of antibiotics, and see, it's hard to think of a world that didn't have them, but, you know, they've only been here between 60 and 70 years. Farmers started using penicillin and tetracycline, and they found out that their cattle grew fatter quicker, that their chickens and pigs could eat these drugs when they were added in bulk to feed. They actually would shovel them into the feed. Even though they had no signs of sickness whatsoever in the animals, they used them to try to boost growth. So 40 years ago, public health officials began to get worried that overuse was leading to this resistance of bacteria to be killed. And so there have been little bursts of activity that have been done by the Food and Drug Administration over the years to try to get farmers and ranchers and veterinarians off of these medicines, because 80% of all the antibiotics that are sold in the United States are used on animals. They're not used on people. But these illnesses that come from resistant bacteria continue to increase. They've not only grown in number, they've grown in severity. And so it was fully a decade ago that the FDA banned the use of medicines like Cipro. Fluoroquinolones is the category of those antibiotics. And so this announcement that came this last month was another one of the FDA's steps to restrict the use of antibiotics. And you know where they've gotten the pushback. They've gotten the pushback from the farmers. You know, the new rule only restricts some of the uses, so it's a pretty modest step. But chipping away at antibiotic availability in farming is important for your health and my health. Because once that resistant bacteria is in the community, it can transfer from person to person. So when the FDA proposed these cephalosporin restrictions back in 2008, the Keflex restrictions, it got so much pushback from the drug companies, from the farmers, from the veterinarians, that the rule that they announced is really less strict than the one that they originally proposed, and it still allows veterinarians to use the drugs to treat sick animals, but it has a tremendous restriction in terms of being able to give these drugs to well animals. So we can't do routine injections into chicken eggs. You didn't know that they were putting antibiotics in your chicken eggs? Now you know why I'm alarmed. So when we look at the nature of the FDA having to step in and reduce antibiotic use, we look around the world and we find out that there are other countries that don't use anywhere near the amount of antibiotics that we use in the United States. There's only a couple of countries, most notably France and Greece, that have the most intense use of antibiotics in the world. Italy and Belgium still beat us out. But we look at places like the Netherlands, where they use less than half of the antibiotics that we use. And so if these infections were really global, if every human had the same response, we would probably have the same proportion of antibiotics that are used all over the place. But I want to talk today about misuse. Because I have seen in my practice, just in the last week, individuals that I think have been hurt, and not just temporarily hurt, but long-term hurt, as a result of repetitive use of antibiotics. And I want to make a statement right here that antibiotics have saved my life. They saved my arm. It is not that antibiotics should be banned. It's simply that they are used so indiscriminately. People go into a physician and they get an antibiotic. At you, and they get an antibiotic. And so individuals often think that antibiotics are benign. And yet very many of the downstream conditions that I see, conditions that were initiated by doses of antibiotics and especially repetitive doses of antibiotics. Because not only have antibiotics been found to be ineffective in the use of in the treatment for sinus infections, they've also found to be ineffective in the treatment of many bronchitis episodes. And so when we look at this two-edged sword, that antibiotics can be lifesavers, and yet at the same time, they can be related to chronic fatigue, and I'm going to talk about that. They can be related to overgrowth of yeast in the bowel and yeasty kinds of problems. They can be related to absolutely life-threatening problems as well as being lifesavers. But more than anything, we know that the misuse has increased the number of drug-resistant germs. So if you think that antibiotic resistance isn't a problem or it doesn't affect you, think again. Not only do we see methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, and you know that is MRSA, we used to think that it was only a concern in the hospital, but the newer forms of MRSA are causing infections even in healthy people in the community. So antibiotic resistance occurs when antibiotics no longer work against these disease-causing organisms. And so I present a hypothesis. I call it Eve's 98 cockroach theory. It's not a pretty theory, but it goes like this. If you put 100 cockroaches in a box and you spray some sort of bug spray in there and 98 of the cockroaches die and 2 live, you know that the 2 that live, they're the baddest roaches in the box. For some reason, they have a natural resistance to the bug spray. Now leave those two roaches in the box for a month, and a month later you got 100 cockroaches in there. And you spray the same bug spray in there that you sprayed the first time. Well, this time 98 of them don't die. Maybe 30 of them die. Because more than two-thirds of those roaches will in one generation become resistant to that bug spray. So then you have to get super bug spray. So you spray the super bug spray in the box, and now 68 of the ones that are left die, and two that are left are the baddest roaches in the box, and you see where we're going with that. Well, exactly the same thing happens with bacteria. When infections happen from these resistant bacteria, they become difficult to treat, and they can mean longer-lasting illnesses, more doctor visits, extended hospital stays, use of even more toxic medications. And, of course, some resistant infections can even cause death. So even though experts are working to develop new antibiotics to try to keep pace with these strains of bacteria, it happens in every environment that when we come up with kill formulas, the bugs are smarter than we are. The same thing has happened with pesticides. We've used pesticides and the bugs become resistant to the pesticides on the plants. We use weed killers and the weeds become resistant. We have a crisis in our nation right now because the Roundup-resistant soybeans, Roundup-resistant corn that Monsanto sold the world have now created super weeds that we can't kill and that are taking over a big part of our farmland. So, yes, there are appropriate places to use antibiotics. But the first thing that we have to remember is they don't work against viruses. And a whole lot of people that get colds and flus believe that if they take an antibiotic, it's going to benefit them. And yet bronchitis and colds and flus and most coughs and most ear infections and most sore throats are in fact viral infections and not bacterial infections. When we talk about bacterial infections, we talk about things like strep throat, sinus infections that last longer than 2 weeks, wound and skin infections such as staph infections, and bladder infections, all of which can be treated without antibiotics. So when we use antibiotics to treat things that they can't treat, like colds or flus or other viral infections, they're not only of no benefit and they're not only expensive, but then they become less effective against the bacteria that they are intended to treat. And very many people don't take antibiotics as they're prescribed. They may take an antibiotic only for a few days instead of taking the full course. And so then we go to the 98 cockroach theory because the antibiotic wipes out some but not all of the bacteria, and the surviving bacteria become more resistant. And then whatever the problem is comes back. And somebody goes back to the doctor, and then they get a stronger antibiotic, and EIEIO. So we want to begin to understand when antibiotics should be used, which is certainly for a life-threatening situation. But we also have to remember not to pressure our physicians for antibiotics, especially if we have a viral illness. So somebody has a stuffy nose or a sore throat, antibiotics should be the last thing that we're grabbing. And in order for us to do that, what we first want to do is to realize that staying healthy is one of the ways that we reduce infections across the board. You know, Mama's sitting right here by the microphone, and Mama would say, prevent the spread of germs and go wash your hands. You know, good hygiene goes a long way in terms of preventing infections. Just washing your hands thoroughly with soap and water, especially after using the toilet or changing a diaper or handling raw meat or poultry. There are antibacterial cleansers and soaps that are on the market, but they're not really necessary. Just plain soap and water work fine to kill germs in most settings, but you actually have to soap up your hands, not just run your hands under running water. So if we just did that, if we just washed our hands more frequently, especially before meals and before handling food and after toilet, we would reduce a tremendous amount of the infections that I see in my practice. You know, antibiotics were first used in the 1940s, and they were an incredibly great advance in medicine. I met an old doctor when I was living in Colorado before I came to my senses and moved back to Florida in 1988. And he was practicing at the time that penicillin was released. And it was quite a miracle at that time. Because he said in those days, one out of two people that got pneumonia died. And that's a pretty horrible thing for a physician to see one out of two people dying from a condition. So when you look at bacteria as living organisms, as single cells, bacteria aren't bad. They live everywhere. They don't cause any harm. And in most cases, they're actually beneficial. Things like lactobacillus that lives in your intestine and helps you to break down your fiber. We have bacteria living all over our body and in our body. It's said that the average human has about 70 to 100 trillion cells in their body. We have more bacteria than that living in our gut. About 4 pounds of bacteria living in our gut. So we know that some bacterial infections are in fact harmful, but we want to understand that we might be able to do some things to resist getting those infections in the first place, and we can start out by paying attention to how much sugar we eat. Yeah, you have heard me the last couple of shows talking about the incredible consumption of sugar that we have in America. But I want to go back to the classic study that was done at Loma Linda University. You know, originally published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, they did a study where they gave people varying amounts of sugar, all the way up to 100 grams of sugar a day. Now, that may not mean a lot to you, but it's darn near 4 ounces. And what they did is they exposed people to these varying amounts of sugar, and then they used their white blood cells to see how much effect those white blood cells had in getting rid of bacteria. You know, white blood cells, there's white blood cells that are like Pac-Men. And I have to be careful when I say that now because teenagers don't know what I'm talking about. But if you remember Pac-Men, you remember that they gobbled up things. And that's the way that some of your white blood cells are. Your white blood cells literally consume bacteria. Now, you probably know people that drink a liter of soda every day, and that's what would have 100 grams of sugar in it. I mean, 8 tablespoons of sugar doesn't really seem like a lot the day after Easter. Researchers found that the sugar started suppressing immune function less than 30 minutes after consumption, and it continued to suppress it for hours afterwards. So I'm not worried about the piece of chocolate that you ate yesterday. I'm worried if you ate a pound of it. But your white blood cells' capacity to kill off bacteria was compromised by more than 40% if you had 8 tablespoons of sugar in the prior 24 hours. This research certainly suggests that constantly eating sugary foods can compromise your immunity. You know, forget about cutting back on sugar to reduce your risk of obesity and other weight-related conditions like diabetes and heart disease. Just your ability to get an infection. So somebody went to the movies last night after they ate through their Easter basket, and the person that was at the movies before them had a wound on their arm, and they laid it on the armrest. And when they left the movie, they left some of that bacteria behind, and the next person came in, and they got it on their body. Well, no problem. There's no place for that bacteria to set hold and cause an infection. But that particular person had been eating sugar all day long. And so rather than their body going after those bacteria and chomping them up, those bacteria can take hold. And so we want to begin to understand that reducing sugar is just one of the ways to do it. We talk all the time here on No Nonsense Nutrition about all of the various things that you can do to be healthier. And what I want us to realize is that there are natural remedies that can be used that can assist our body in getting rid of harmful bacteria once we're exposed to them. You know, simply put, antibiotics are poisons that are used to kill. That's the reason only licensed physicians can prescribe them. There's no question how many people have benefited from using them. But what I wonder is, if you take a poison that kills small organisms in small doses, can it also kill big organisms if you take a little bit, a little bit, a little bit? But even more than that, I have to look at the link between funguses and human disease. Because these microbes that are harmful, as well as the microbes that are beneficial, that live in your gut, that 3.5 or 4 pounds of bacteria that live in your bowel, when you swallow an antibiotic, you don't just kill the bad guys. You also kill the beneficial bacteria within your intestines, and you upset this incredibly delicate balance of the intestinal terrain so that, you know, individuals, they take antibiotics, they get diarrhea. You know, women that take antibiotics and they end up with a vaginal yeast infection. Yeast are opportunistic organisms. This means as the intestinal bacteria die, the yeasts thrive, especially when their dietary needs are met. And yeasts love sugar. They love sugar. That's really the only thing they eat, because yeasts don't have a digestive tract. And when yeasts turn into their fungal form, they develop little roots, little mycelium, hyphae they're called. And they literally poke holes through the lining of your intestinal wall and create a syndrome called leaky gut syndrome. Now, yeasts are not the only cause of this syndrome. We've definitely linked leaky gut system to repetitive use of naproxen and ibuprofen, those non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that some people take every day, every day, every day. They also alter the intestinal milieu, the mix, the ecology of what's going on in the bowel. But these yeasts, as they turn parasitic, can encourage you to binge on carbohydrates. So I had a client that came to me one time years and years ago, and she was a real straight apple gal, came in a navy blue suit. She was a banker, very conventional, very conservative. She sat across the desk from me and she said, "Eve, you don't know me, but I really am a very reasonable woman." She says, "But I'm going to tell you something that isn't going to sound very reasonable. I feel like I have aliens living in my belly." Well, certainly she got my attention with that comment. And she says, "I don't mean aliens from outer space." She said, "I feel like I have something living in my belly that makes me eat sugar, that makes me eat cookies, that makes me want sweets." Well, you know, I'd heard that story before, but I'd never heard it put in quite that context. And we did a stool study on this woman, and we discovered that, in fact, she did have an overgrowth of yeast in her belly. And we treated that yeast and eliminated it. And I remember her next visit when she walked in and she said, "The aliens are dead." So if you're one of the people who wants to binge on pasta and bread and sugar and potatoes and candy and get the, you know, telltale sign of weight gain as a result, we may need to look at yeast overgrowth as one of the possibilities. And that yeast overgrowth may have come after a series of antibiotics. And I say series because I have so many clients in my practice that come in, they have a dental procedure, they get an antibiotic, they get another dental procedure, they get another antibiotic. And so those antibiotics, as they change the terrain or the milieu or the ecology of the gut, then create the opportunity for yeast to take over. Not only can yeast poke holes in the lining of your intestinal wall and create leaky gut syndrome, not only can yeast cause you to binge out on carbohydrates, but yeast can also make food sensitivities more likely. And these are not allergies, they're sensitivities. It's sad to me that most doctors ignore intestinal discomfort. The national tour that I'm doing right now, teaching doctors around the United States, the name of the seminar is Solving the Belly Blues, because I see that really as the foundation of health. When your belly's working good, everything works good. When your belly's not working good, nothing else matters. So when we look at the tons of antibiotics that are fed to American livestock on a daily basis, antibiotics that are given to animals that aren't sick, well, fat cattle sell for more than thin cattle. And so the FDA's restriction of this category of cephalosporin antibiotics is one more step to reducing the amount of antibiotics that we have in American livestock. But when we look at the nature of the amount of antibiotics that are used on all of these animals, they are continuing. Now, they're not going to continue at the rate that they were, but they're still continuing. And so when we look at this use of antibiotics in animals, we're asking, are you getting some effect of those antibiotics when you're eating those animals? Are you getting the effect of antibiotics when you're drinking a glass of milk? You know, when you buy a carton of milk, we have a tendency to believe that all the milk in that carton came out of one cow. But in fact, you have a farm, and I have a farm, and somebody else has a farm, and all three of us sell our milk to a co-op. And all the milk from all three of those farms, or 10 farms, or 20 farms, all goes into a vat together. And maybe I use a different series of antibiotics on my dairy cattle than you use. And as a result, there are many antibiotics that are in that milk. The United States Department of Agriculture did a buy recently, and they found as many as 40 antibiotics in a single quart of milk. So when we begin to look at the antibiotics that are used, we ask, are they tested for safety? And researchers began to test the toxicity of over 300 different antibiotics. Blows your mind that there's that many, doesn't it? And what they do is they figure out how much antibiotic is required to kill mice. Yes, it's a horrible story, but stay with me. They didn't even start doing some of these studies until 15 years after penicillin was out. And when they find what will kill a mouse, then they say that half of that amount is okay for a human. But what if you get repetitive doses over years and years? We don't know what this scenario is going to give us. You know, there's one doctor's work that I read that was very interested in the time span between when patients take rounds of antibiotics and when they die, because he believed that very few people actually died of their condition, that oftentimes they died from treatments that they received, most notably antibiotic treatments that they received. And so when we look at people that have had a long history of taking antibiotics, whatever for, you know, a lot of people take antibiotics to treat their acne, and they may be on them for a year or two. I probably see one of those clients in my practice every month. There are some individuals that go on maintenance antibiotics for various immune conditions. But antibiotics actually are mycotoxins in and of themselves. I mean, if you think back into the 1940s, when you think back to the point that penicillin was found, it was found in a petri dish where mold had contaminated the petri dish, and the mold was the fungus. Remember, funguses, molds, and yeast are all the same family. The compound that the mold secreted, the mycotoxin, was what actually killed the bacteria. So when we realize that antibiotics are actually fungal metabolites, that they're actually microtoxins, we begin to wonder then if you get a fungus growing in your belly, if you get a fungus growing in your sinuses. Because Johns Hopkins University says 9 out of 10 fungal infections that are happening, or 9 out of 10 sinus infections are actually fungal infections. We used to believe that fungal sinusitis was very rare, that fungal bronchitis, fungal asthma was very rare. Doesn't seem like it's all that rare anymore. So they cultured what was in the nose or the chest of individuals that had repetitive asthma and repetitive bronchitis and repetitive sinusitis, and they found there weren't any bacteria there. They were funguses. So when we look at this combination of a fungal metabolite together with a weakened immune system, the combination can be deathly. We see so many more immune syndromes in practice today. You know, 10 years ago, the asthma and allergy, it's a coalition of physicians. I don't remember the name of the organization yet, but the allergy and asthma people. They gave a report back at the turn of the century because the first immunodeficiency syndrome was only identified in 1952. So 50 years later, they did this report. And now we're up to somewhere between 80 and 95 different immune syndromes that have been identified. And one of the things that they put in that report was that increased antibiotic use in human infancy may be associated with an increased risk of developing allergies. Increased antibiotic use in human infancy. It's hard for me to find a child who is 5 years old that comes into my practice that hasn't had antibiotics of something. So when we look at the use of the question to take or not to take antimicrobials, the first thing that I want to do is look at natural remedies. And the real surprise is that natural antibiotics are way more effective than many people realize. The harm is the unnatural antibiotics. And so we start out with one of the most natural antibiotics that exists, and that's garlic. I remember the first time I went up on the reservation to meet one of the weed women who was living, and that was what the affectionate term was for herbalists on the reservation, were weed women. To meet one of the weed women that was living on the reservation up in northeastern Arizona, and somebody came to her with a complaint of a sinus problem, and she took two garlic bulbs, and she pulled off the clove of garlic and peeled it, and she took a little pin, and she barely pricked the garlic, just barely breaking the skin, maybe pricked it 2-3 dozen times all over the garlic, not enough to unstabilize the clove, but just enough to break the surface. And she told the person to put those two garlic cloves in their nose. Well, the active compound in garlic is called allicin, which is very similar to penicillin. And one of the things that's really good about garlic is that it works against a broad spectrum of harmful bacteria. So this person sat in her hogan, in her house, with these two garlic cloves sitting up his nose, laid back on a bed. And she put some music on a tape recorder, lovely, beautiful flute music, and told the person to relax and just breathe in the smell of the garlic. Well, I thought I had stepped back into the 18th century at that point. And yet, it worked like a modern broad-spectrum antibiotic. So not only was that not used on the reservation because it was costly, because garlic is certainly a cheap food that does its job without producing harmful side effects, but she had the individual crush a clove and eat that clove, one clove of garlic, once an hour over the course of the rest of the day. Sent him out of there with two more garlic cloves that had been pricked that way and told him to wait an hour and do it again. Put him back up his nose and leave him in there. for an hour and then take them out. That's it. That was the treatment. I stayed overnight on the res that night, and he came back the next day and brought the woman a beautiful piece of lamb that was his payment for the treatment that she had given him. So if you want to maximize the natural antibiotic benefits of garlic, it's always best to eat it raw, and it's always best to crush it, let it sit for 5 minutes, and then take it. Because the allicin, the active ingredient, gets worked on by an enzyme, alanase, and that helps to activate it. You can also suck raw garlic cloves just as you would suck a lozenger, either by placing them inside your cheeks or under your tongue. The taste is pretty mild. It's not the strong, pungent effect of biting or chewing raw garlic. In fact, the taste is so mild you get tempted to bite it when some of that pungence emerges, but I've seen that used in order to treat a sore throat. Now, if you don't like the taste, you can swallow it down with some hot water or some hot soup, or get some garlic oil capsules in the health food store, not the aged garlic. But something simple like garlic, something simple like onion. I've told the story before about walking through a graveyard out in England, in rural England, and seeing a gravestone of a woman who died at 108, and on her tombstone it said, "I owe it all to onions." Onions have natural antibiotic properties. So eat an onion a day keeps the doctor away may actually be better than eating an apple a day to keep the doctor away. But you know, there are plenty of herbs that we can buy, from tea tree oil and lavender oil to golden seal powder and echinacea to umeboshi plums and olive leaf extract, from oregano oil to the plant Uva ursi that I use very commonly for urinary tract infections. Uva ursi. Uva, you can hear ova in that word, Latin word, and ova in Latin means egg, but there's no eggs on plants, so uva on a plant is a berry, the egg of the plant, or the berry of the plant. Ursi, you've heard of the constellation, the Great Bear, Ursa Major, so ursi means bear, so uva ursi is egg of the bear, or bearberry. Uva ursi is a very important herb to use, especially for urinary tract infections. I usually use it as a tincture, which is an alcohol solvent of that berry, to extract the medicinal components out of it, 30 drops in a little snort of water 3 to 5 times a day. So, you know, what you want to understand about these natural remedies is these natural remedies are effective. You know, echinacea is an American Indian herb popularly used to treat sore throats and coughs. Echinacea grows out in West Texas. We use the root. And so the nature of echinacea, taking echinacea root tincture, taking echinacea root powder, will upregulate the white blood cells' ability to kill bacteria. You might have heard of supplements like beta-glucans. Beta-glucans is another one that upregulates white blood cells, turns them into snipers so that they go after things that are infective. You know, we're very fortunate that we have excellent beekeepers here in Sarasota. Beekeepers that are maintaining their hives in a really healthy way and allowing us to take honey that has natural pollen that helps to inoculate you against allergy season next year. But one of the things that we get out of beehives is a compound called propolis. It's a natural resin that bees collect from plant sap and flower buds. And not only do they use it to seal gaps in the hive, but they prevent decomposition within the hive. So if a small animal like a lizard entered into the hive and dies there, the bees seal it off with propolis, making it like a mummy. They render it harmless. They render it odorless. Well, propolis has natural antibiotic properties, antiviral properties, antifungal properties. Now, the composition of propolis depends on where the bees come from and what kind of resins they collect, but propolis tablets and lozenges are sold at health food stores, and a lot of people can just pop one of those in when they get the first sign of a sore throat. Propolis can be made into a tincture and can be used in, as an antibiotic that way. Many people are aware that punk trees that we have here in Sarasota County are also called Malalucas. When I visited Australia, I was startled to find out that there are 70 different species of Malaleuca trees. And using the oil from that tree, the tea tree oil, for everything from athlete's foot to ringworm. Tea tree oil may even be effective against lice. It certainly is used by a lot of people to treat toe fungus. It's a powerful antimicrobial. It's a remedy for fungal infections. Lavender oil, another natural antiseptic. Actually, all of the essential oils have natural antiseptic properties. Lavender oil can relieve pain on the skin. I keep a bottle of it in my kitchen. Because if you burn yourself on the oven rack, just put some lavender oil on it right away. So when we begin to look at these natural remedies, we can't forget even simple things like honey. I remember the first time that I saw a member of one of the First Nations, the Native Americans, use honey to treat an infected wound. A kid that had been running barefoot in a place that he certainly shouldn't have been running barefoot and got nasty piece of old barbed wire jammed in his foot. And they washed it thoroughly. And they put honey on it. Well, modern therapeutic agents were costly. They failed them. And so the effectiveness of honey in clearing infection from wounds has been demonstrated all over the world. It may actually actively promote healing. It's actually being used in the burn hospitals in Texas now. So, when you begin to shift your thinking from believing that antibiotics are the miracle drug and the be-all, end-all, and you move to an idea that there may be a natural remedy. You know, I look at something like Helicobacter pylori. The role of this bacteria in stomach ulcers has been totally clarified. It's now been found in 90% of people who have duodenal ulcers and 70% of people with gastric ulcers. It may be related to stomach cancer and even inflammation throughout the body. They've even implicated it in heart disease. It can cause lifetime gastritis. For many patients, it's implicated in reflux and heartburn. And so this particular bacteria is treated with a really nasty set of antibiotics, amoxicillin, Prevpac, combination therapies that often don't eliminate the problem. And yet the use of broccoli seed extract, sulforaphane glucosinolate, has been shown to eradicate Helicobacter pylori. I had a client in practice last week, and we did a stool study, and we found out that of the 6 antibiotics that were tested against the bacteria that was found in their gut, 3 of them didn't work. It was already resistant to 3 of the 6 antibiotics. But the one botanical that did work was grapefruit seed extract. And so these citrus seed extracts, in this case grapefruit seed extract, was a non-prescription preparation that would actually kill the nasty bacteria that was living in their bowel. So whether it's garlic or onions or turmeric or ginger or cinnamon, sage, rosemary, oregano, thyme, all of those things have natural antibiotic properties. But we got to change our mind. We have to change our mind into believing that modern miracle medicine may not be such a miracle. And we have to change our mind in terms of deciding we want to be as healthy as possible so we don't get any of these bugs in the first place. you know, Norway is the one that's really winning the award. Norway and the Netherlands, we ought to be paying attention to what they're doing, because they are the winners of the hit parade. There isn't any doubt about it. Norway has the lowest rate of methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, MRSA. Out of any country in the world, the U.S., and Japan and some of the southern European countries have the highest rate of MRSA in the world. And so when we look at antibiotics as the standard treatment for staph infections, in Norway, they decided way back in the 80s, when the FDA was just starting to think about reducing antibiotic availability, they decided to limit the amount of prescription antibiotics that could be used by their doctors. Their doctors were educated in limiting the use of antibiotics, especially for things that antibiotics can't help, like colds and flus. They became much more careful about using broad-spectrum antibiotics for infections. They started monitoring all over Norway any incidence of MRSA within their healthcare facilities, and they isolated and treated those admitted. It was interesting, when I went in for my back surgery down at Venice Regional Hospital, they did a nose swab looking for MRSA. But when I went to Sarasota Memorial Hospital and I had my shoulder surgery, they didn't check it. So by prescribing less antibiotics to people and animals, there is less exposure of antibiotics to bacteria, and thus less chance for the bacteria to become resistant. So what is Norway doing right? It appears they're doing everything right. So these high MRSA infection rates have been correlated to countries that prescribe the most antibiotic. France has one of the highest prescription antibiotic uses in the world. But, you know, it's also interesting to note that Norway forbids pharmaceutical companies to advertise antibiotic drugs, or any other drug for that matter, directly to the consumer. That may have another thing to do with the driving of the sales of all drugs, not just antibiotics. When you have a change of mind and you start paying more attention to preventing infection, just washing thoroughly, it's a pretty easy recommendation. Mom made it, I'm making it. Just wash your hands a little bit more often. That's a place to start. Especially when you handle food, especially before you eat, especially after you go to the toilet. Remember all these antibiotic sprays and antibiotic gels and antibiotic soaps? They may not really be doing us any favors. They may actually be contributing to antibiotic resistance. So some of you germaphobes out there that are spraying the sink and using the hand cleaner and all like that, you may not actually be doing yourselves any favors. Yes, antibiotics are appropriate to use. You got a high fever? Got a pussy wound forming? Antibiotics may be exactly the most appropriate thing to do.